Dr. Quill is the son of a missionary pastor who was in Africa and in California. So as he talks about mission opportunities worldwide, he has lived it his entire life. He graduated from Concordia Seward, got his MDiv from Concordia St. Louis. He got his PhD from Drew University in New Jersey. He's married to Annette, and he has a 16-year-old daughter. And let me tell you, I've got two daughters. God bless you, Tim. You got one. And he's been here since 1996. He teaches in the Pastoria Theology Department, and he's Dean of International Ministries. His secretary, Judy Bascom, really assists him in coordinating everything. When I first came on board, I had the opportunity to visit with Dr. Quill about our outreach here internationally, and I was really, truly impressed with the work that he's doing, because our professors are asked to teach in seminaries, Lutheran seminaries worldwide. On top of that, men are asking to come here to study undergraduate and postgraduate studies, and that's what Tim works on, is getting those men over here. And what this will do is help the gospel be fulfilled. So it is my privilege to welcome Dr. Timothy Quill. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Shortly after Dr. Wenthy was elected president at Concordia Theological Seminary in 1996, the Schwann Foundation gave a grant to enable us to develop a Russian program, a Russian project, as we called it. We called it a project because it was only intended to last for 4 years. It went on to 6 years, and it was things worked out very well. The Russian project always sounded strange when I went to Russia. It sounded like the Manhattan Project. So when I was in Russia, I usually referred to it as a program. Nearly 40 people have studied in the program, including, you don't see them in the picture, but 6 women who are now back and serve as translators, church musicians, and there's one deaconess. These students came from Russia, Kazakhstan, Ukraine, Moldova, Belarus, Lithuania, and Latvia. And with few exceptions, they've all returned back where they're serving their church in all types of capacities, assistant to bishops on church consistories. It's like their board of directors of synod. Some are teaching in seminaries, but most of them, even with those duties, are serving as missionary pastors. It soon became apparent that there was a great need for more pastors, since the thousands of Lutheran pastors in the Russian Empire that once existed had been pretty much eliminated. Thousands of them were killed. And so we needed a lot more. Russia needs a lot more than this. So it was apparent that there was a need to train men in Russia. And so in September of 1997, Fort Wayne assisted the young Siberian Lutheran Church with the establishment of Lutheran Theological Seminary in Novosibirsk, Siberia. It's Siberia, but that place looks pretty much like northern Indiana. It's very beautiful. It can get very hot and humid in the summer and very cold in the winter, though our deployed faculty man over there, Professor Ludwig, scoffs at the cold and drives the Russians crazy. He says, "I'm from South Dakota. And this is nothing. We have cold and wind, and they don't have as much wind out there." The first thing I'd like to do is show you the seminary that exists. And I think it's best to let the Russians do the speaking themselves, because they put together a nice little video. The purpose of it was to show other Russian-speaking men in different countries of the former Soviet Union what the seminary is like. Sort of a recruitment thing for Russians. And it has attracted men from different countries to study there. We were able to get it dubbed into English, and actually it's some remarkable videos. So if John could turn it on, we'll watch that.
We got caught in the rain. We won't make it in time for the service. Well, they will have to bear with us.
The new seminary building was dedicated by Bishop Yanis Kalvanis, who came from, at their request, from Lithuania, from the Evangelical Lutheran Church of Lithuania, and he consecrated the building, and on the same day he also ordained six clergymen who now serve the church and their mission stations, places from Ekaterinburg in the Ural Mountains in the east, in the west, all the way to Chita in the east, on the other side of Lake Baikal. They hope to start new congregations even further east in Khabarovsk, Sakhalin Island, where the rector is actually, where he grew up. I just got an email today that his father died, and so he's flying back to Sakhalin for the funeral. And then also in Kamchatka, because one of the students grew up there, and his goal after he's done in Tomsk is to go back and start a Lutheran church in his home region. The mother congregation of the Siberian Evangelical Lutheran Church is located in the suburb of Novosibirsk, also known as Akademgorodok, or Academic City. The city was built in the 1950s as a major university center and also for numerous scientific institutes where they embarked on a lot of their secret research. They put it way out in Siberia where they felt it was safer. It was a closed city. They also did a lot of biochemical research. Many of the founding members of what is now the Evangelical Lutheran Church in Siberia were university students. Some of them, parents were actually the scientists that worked there. It was amazing the first time we went to be teaching these young kids that grew up under communist scientists and atheists. The most challenging mission work takes place in the rural areas where economic conditions are often pitiful. Graduates of our seminary in Fort Wayne and also the new seminary, as you saw in Novosibirsk, are assigned to some of these remote regions. Places like Khakhasia, which you saw, and that tragic village of Karovo. Mission work centers on the preaching of the gospel and the administration of the sacraments. It just seems so obvious to us, but there's so many mission models out there this day that sets these things off at the side. But when you watch them work, the word and the sacrament really constitutes how they see church and missions. Catechism is crucial for people who have lived under atheistic communism for 70 years. Diaconic work or human care is also an important part of the church's outreach. Seminaries make pastors. The focus is on preparing men to faithfully preach the gospel, to give holy absolution, baptize, administer the sacraments, and give pastoral care to the troubled, the sick, and the dying. They're just getting experienced at the dying part, because for quite a few years they didn't have many old people, and they didn't have anyone who ever died. I once asked them when I was teaching homiletics about funerals, and well, they hadn't had one in the congregation yet, but they have since. In fact, one of the first men to die, you saw him with the beard teaching in the prison. He graduated from here, is only back a short while, and a drug addict who escaped, who they let out of prison, stabbed him to death in front of the altar, because the church and the apartment where he lived served double purpose. So it was quite a tragedy. You spend all that money bringing him over here, training him all that time, and then he gets killed, and you kind of wonder, what is God thinking? How much is a pastor worth? Well, that was answered when we found out that he was from Moldova. He is one of the reasons why we are in Moldova today. His parents lived there. They had to come to Russia to pick up his body. Because of his witness, his mother was, and father were baptized by Pastor Litkin, who you saw in the film. And because of that, we are working with the reestablishment of the Lutheran Church in Moldova. Seminaries make pastors. Nevertheless, the Russian project was initiated in 1996, or since it was initiated in 1996, professors from our seminary have reached hundreds of laity, and they've traveled all over the Soviet Union doing this through a summer seminar outreach program. Each summer, our professors travel, usually at least three or four in Russia itself, to different towns and cities. The topics that they talk about are, we ask the Russians, what do you want us to talk about? And consistently, from the very beginning, they say, we want somebody to talk about the early church. Well, they want to know if this Lutheranism is a sect, or if what we teach can be found in the church Catholic, the church apostolic. They, of course, want scripture. They want the liturgy. Some of this goofy liturgy that's going on today in many American churches is not what they want. They want something of substance, something serious. And so they often have request lectures on baptism and the Lord's Supper, and other things as well. In 1998, Dr. Barbara Resch, wife of Cantor Resch, lectured on sacred music and met with church musicians. That same year, President Wenthe lectured on the Old Testament. A good number of the participants speak English, but most of them require translators. And fortunately, we are blessed with some brilliant young translators, men and women, who not only have a superb command of the English language, but also have a good command of biblical and theological language. One of the translators, Olga, has studied here, studied Latin and Greek and Hebrew as well. We average about four summer seminars each summer in Russia, some in large cities like Novosibirsk, Ekaterinburg, Tomsk, Khakhassia, Irkutsk. But we've also gone to some very isolated places like Lake Baikal, the Altai Mountains, which are on the Chinese border, and in Chita, which is east of Lake Baikal. At this seminar in Chita, there was an old lady who came. This was the second one we did. And this time she brought with her, there was about seven young ladies in their early 20s. And they never looked at me. They just sat in the back row and looked, and I thought they didn't like me. I thought they were just mean or something. I found out later, I should have done what I always do. I just go up and talk to people, grab a translator. I wish I would have, because I found out later they were just scared. They came from a small village three 4 hours south of Chita on the Chinese border. It's so remote, these girls had never even seen a train. I mean, it's not like they weren't educated or they had a school there. They'd never been to a big city until they went to Chita, if you can imagine that being a big city. But this old lady brought them, and eventually the pastors made trips, catechized them and baptized them. Their town has no church, not even a Russian Orthodox church. But now there's the nucleus of a congregation there. We have also had several summer seminars in Belarus, Lithuania, Ukraine, and in the tiny country of Moldova, which I mentioned. That's a little sliver of a country right next to Ukraine on the west side. Actually, we didn't go to, well, we went to Moldova, but we actually went to a country that isn't on the map, a little country that exists along the edge between Moldova and Ukraine called Transnistria, and it's not recognized by the international community. We had to wind around some tanks and Russian armaments to get over the bridge into the country, which doesn't exist. There was a civil war, there's a ceasefire, and the Russians are serving as peacekeepers. We've also held numerous seminars in Kazakhstan, one in Kyrgyzstan. In August of 2001, I traveled to Uzbekistan. Interesting way to kind of work towards Islam, come in from the north. Well, I traveled to Uzbekistan to meet with a Lutheran bishop, Cornelius Wiebe. The purpose was to discuss the possibility of having him send his young men, future pastors, to study in Novosibirsk. We also invited Wiebe to study at our seminary in Fort Wayne. I'm glad you can't see that picture too well. He brought me that hat, and I was inclined to wear it. That's Bishop Wiebe on the right. While in Uzbekistan, we had a chance to visit the walled city of Bukhara, once one of the most powerful cities in the region and the home of the famous Timurlane. I don't know if you know Timurlane, but his brutality made Genghis Khan look like a first-year seminarian. It took half a day to drive there, and we were constantly being stopped at military checkpoints. We really didn't know why. We were told that, well, that's because there are some rebel groups running around in Uzbekistan, something called Al-Qaeda or something. I'd never heard of it. 3 weeks later, on September 11th, we all found out about who they were. This summer, we have been asked by the new Lutheran Church in Georgia to conduct a seminar for their church leaders. They have five congregations, but they don't have a pastor, not a single one. So I met with their president, Mr. Kaha Pithava, and he actually came to Novosibirsk last March when I was there and said, we've heard about this seminary. Can you train our young men? You know, it takes 4 years plus a year of internship, vicarage. So he invited us there to do a seminar, and he gave me four names of some young men, which will be interviewed. And that doesn't mean they get to go. They've got to, it's much better to have very high standards, otherwise they won't make it. And Dr. Weinrich will lecture on early church, I'll lecture on the liturgy, and Alexei Streltsov on the Augsburg Confession. In Lithuania, Dr. Charles Evanson is deployed by the seminary. Concordia Seminary has developed a very close relationship with the Evangelical Lutheran Church of Lithuania. I could spend a whole hour just on that. I'll just summarize by saying that in March of 2000, Bishop Kalvinas asked President Wenthe if it would be possible to send Dr. Charles Evanson full-time to move and live there and teach, because we had sent him over for 10 weeks to teach, and they got a little taste of him, and he felt this is something our church needs. So he's been actually, his contract is with the Lutheran Church there, and with us, and with the University of Klaipeda, which has a theology department, and that's where all their pastors in Lithuania have to go to get a degree. Unfortunately, the seminary, the department has some good things, but it's not a seminary. It has many liberal visiting professors from Germany, one local guy who's basically an atheist, secret communist still. They have one reform guy who's good, but you know he's not Lutheran. And they now have a young Darius Bakunas who is gonna get his doctorate any day. He's very confessional, but it's just vital to have him there. The students just love him, because unlike so many of the old Soviet type of professors whose tactic is their teaching pedagogy is just intimidate and scare. Here they find a guy who loves them and encourages them and gets the best out of the students. So the students really love him. President Wenthe traveled to Lithuania to bestow an honorary doctorate on Dr. Evanson. Professor Evanson also meets once a month and runs seminars, theological seminars for the Lithuanian pastors. Quite a few of them do not have a theological education, formal education. 2 years ago, I was appointed Dean of International Studies. The Russian students are all gone now. You saw them, their picture. That program is done. But we still have many international students working on graduate degrees. The International Studies Office coordinates the travel of our professors abroad and also oversees the foreign students here on campus. At the time when I was appointed to this position, I didn't think that it would be overly complicated since I'd been involved with the Russian project. And then September 11th, shortly after this position, that happened. And everything changed, you know that. Everything in America changed, travel changed. Well, few people realize how this has affected international students in America. Foreign students studying in America have always faced financial, language, cultural challenges and adjustments. Since September 11th, all American universities, colleges, and seminaries have faced new strict laws governing the issuance of a document called an I-20, which is necessary for the students to go to their embassy, our embassy in their country, and get a student visa so they can come to the United States. Every I-20 used to be just written out on a piece of paper signed by maybe the business manager and you mail it over to them. Now every I-20 is sent from the educational institution directly to the government Department of Immigration and National Services and the foreign embassy at the same time. It's all done on a newly created electronic computer program. No visa will be granted by the government unless proof of financial support for the entire duration of the academic program is provided. Tuition, academic fees, room, board, travel to and from the United States, insurance. Furthermore, the location and academic status of all students is strictly regulated and monitored. For example, if a student moves, if he's in an apartment with a family and he moves to another apartment, he must inform the school, which is required to electronically inform the INS of his change of address. If a full-time student drops one class in violation and goes below what he's supposed to be taking, he can be in violation of status. Institutions, including CTS, must abide by all new regulations or we will lose the right to invite foreign students to campus. For the first time in history, the United States government, according to its new policy, sent a representative to our campus, like they're doing to all campuses, to make an on-site visit. As one of my titles in this is primary designated school officer, I, along with Judy Bascom, who is the DSO, and really the one who does all the computer work, I can't survive without her, they came in, interviewed us, randomly checked about 6 or 7 files of students to make sure everything was in order and to see that they are actually here studying, attending classes, making academic progress, appropriate progress, not in violation of any rules. So if you're just wondering about this, it's a whole new ball game, and I think it's good for America. Before 9/11, the U.S. borders were wide open. Every year, thousands of foreigners applied for student visas, came to America, and many of them never even showed up on campus. Their financial affidavits that they had provided were bogus. They just disappeared into America's cities. That wasn't really a major problem here, but we did have a few foreign students that tried to get around the rules and stay. It is understandable that the new Department of Homeland Security is now cracking down. I have a Department of Homeland Security flowchart on my wall in the office. As a DSO, I am responsible to the BCIS, the Bureau of, I had to learn a whole new language to do this, the Bureau of Citizen and Immigration Services. I finally learned that one, BCIS, and not another one that sounds the same. And then we found out that there's a little controversy going on because the FBI doesn't like them using the word Bureau. So now we're back to calling it INS, but it's BCIS, and I'm down here under that one, and if you track it all the way up, I know my boss is President Wenthe, and I'm accountable to him, and my job is to do what's good for the seminary, but it's also, we have a responsibility to individual needs of the students, so there's two things. And then there's a third one, we've got a responsibility to the government if we want the students here. And if I ever have any trouble with a student, which isn't too often, I kind of point at the chart to let them know that my boss is the Director of Homeland Security. It hasn't intimidated anybody yet, I don't think, but I thought it might work. Robert Gates, the former director of the CIA, is now president of Texas A&M University, and he recently made these observations. Osama bin Laden and other terrorists are on the brink of achieving an unanticipated victory, one that could have long-term consequences for the United States. Over the decades, millions of young people from other countries have come to America to study at our colleges and universities. After September 11th, for perfectly understandable reasons, the federal government made it much tougher to get a visa to come to the United States. Sadly, the unpredictability and delays that characterize the new system, and too often the indifference or hostility to those doing the processing, have resulted over the last year or so in a growing number of the world's brightest young people deciding to remain at home or go to other countries for their college and graduation education. Thousands of legitimate international students are being denied entry into the United States or are giving up in frustration and anger. At 90% of Americans' colleges and universities, applications from international students for the fall of 2004 are down. According to the recent article in the Chronicle of Higher Education, applications from China have fallen 76%, while those from India, 58%. On the negative side is that the good that America has to offer, as far as our democracy and other things, we lose an opportunity to influence the good students in this way. Concordia Theological Education has responded with the creation of a new position, namely the Dean of International Studies and the new International Studies Office. We face new challenges, regulations, frustrations every day, but we remain passionately committed to overcoming these obstacles so that Lutherans from around the world may continue to take advantage of the faculty and the campus life at Fort Wayne. International students are necessary for Concordia Theological Seminary in that they keep the administration, they keep the faculty and the student body connected to the broader Lutheran world community. No Lutheran church can survive in isolation. Neither can a confessing seminary. The international mission enterprise is faced with a complexity of political, cultural, economic, ecumenical, and linguistic challenges. The challenge for all those involved in mission work is to train indigenous pastors in both theology and prayer. The challenge for those involved in missions is also implanting the liturgy in the local language or culture. This is no small task. It requires translation and composition of liturgical texts that are biblically faithful and theologically correct and clear. It requires liturgical texts and hymnody that are both linguistically and sound and poetically beautiful. It requires thoughtful attention to music and rite and ceremony. Training the first generation of Lutheran pastors in the art of pastoral care in a culture where the Christian church does not exist, is particularly challenging. My father was a pastor. I was amazed how much I knew what to do and didn't know why, just growing up in a parsonage. Pastoral care cannot be learned from class lectures and books alone. I know, that's what I teach. Spiritual care is learned by observing seasoned pastors in action and in the school of experience. It's amazing to look at that video and see these young first-generation pastors with no older generation to model them. But they're doing a remarkable job. They're learning as they go along. Another serious challenge for Lutheran missions comes from the powerful influence of the liberal German and Scandinavian Lutheran state churches, the Lutheran World Federation churches in Europe, are perplexed that churches in the former Soviet Union and around the world find the theology of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod and other confessional Lutheran churches appealing. In an attempt to understand this phenomenon, they resort to some very fanciful explanations. For example, in his address to the Evangelical Commission for the Middle and Eastern Europe, which met in Brandenburg in April of 2002, Bishop Stefan Rader, who is a bishop, a liberal German bishop in St. Petersburg, put forth this thesis. The theology of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod comes to a large extent in answer to the present-day needs of the people of the former Soviet Union because it has a Soviet character. You know, I've read this to the Russians a couple times and Lithuanians, and they laughed harder than you did. They just, you know, they're nonplussed, what can I say? The address notes that under the Soviet system, values and ideals were clearly designated. What was good and bad and evil, true and false, were clearly defined. Even if all citizens did not agree with the alleged Soviet identity, it was, however, a point of orientation. With the fall of the Soviet Union, the state was no longer able to sufficiently offer a national identity. Therefore, many are turning to religious and spiritual movements to shape their self-identity. Religions that offer complete and predetermined answers in what is good and right and wrong remain more appealing to those coming out of the Soviet world. And then Bishop Rader posits, herein lies the unmistakable strength of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. It asserts an unambiguous It's clear and unambiguous answers and corresponds, therefore, in a certain fashion to the Soviet ideology. An independently thinking people was out of the question in Soviet times. The Soviet government did the thinking for the people. The people rarely learned to think for themselves. Herein lies the strength of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod theology. Here one doesn't need to think. Here it is offered a complete system with a full claim to truth which one can adopt for himself. The Soviet Union ideology had the proclivity for explaining all the fundamental things on the basis of indisputable authorities and writings, Marx, Lenin, and so forth. The Missouri Synod does this in the same way, in that it subscribes itself uncritically to Luther and the Lutheran confessions, and looks at all these as completely infallible, as a completely infallible foundation. Okay, guilty. Statues of Lenin are still remain in the central squares of almost every city and town in Russia. All the ones you saw torn down were in the satellites, Kazakhstan, the CIS countries, but not Russia. There was once a large, thriving Lutheran congregation in downtown Irkutsk. The communists destroyed the church and intentionally placed the statue of Lenin directly over the altar. It's not a real good picture, but it's the stones actually came from the church on the base of the altar. What irony. Lenin shed the blood of millions, and he's now dead. Jesus shed his holy blood for the sins of the world, and he's alive. And his church is once again alive in Irkutsk, giving the body and blood of our Lord to Lutherans. Do the Lutherans in Russia and the former Soviet the Lutherans in Russia and the former Soviet Union are worthy of more respect than Rader's analysis. The patronizing rhetoric expressed in the Brandenburg Address is more reflective of the verbal nominalism of past Soviet propaganda than of the present-day Lutherans in the Russia, CIS, and Baltic countries, who are quite capable of thinking for themselves. When confessional Lutheran pastors and bishops like these from, these from Latvia, Lithuania, Germany, Belarus, and Russia, when they choose a theological course instead of a sociologically based ideology, like you get in the Lutheran World Federation, they are labeled as narrow-minded and fundamentalist. Despite hemorrhaging membership losses in the liberal churches of Western Europe and Scandinavia, the leadership of the established Lutheran churches continue to force their agenda on churches that have no desire for it. In Latvia, Bishop Vanags expressed a common sentiment found among these churches. Quote, the churches that have lived under persecution, for churches that have lived under persecution, liberalism has nothing to offer because it has nothing to die for. The struggling emerging Lutherans often find strings attached to the financial help they are offered from their brothers in the West. Individual pastors and congregations are courted and tempted with financial rewards to change their doctrine and practice. Lutherans in Africa are experiencing the Lutheran World Federation arrogance and oppression as well. In his opening address to the Fourth International Confessional Lutheran Conference in Matanga Seminary in Kenya, Bishop Walter Obari pointedly reacted to the liberal theological pressures coming to his country from Europe and Scandinavia. He writes, "We are grateful for the beneficial work of various Bible schools and of the past. Simultaneously, it is, however, of extreme importance to acknowledge the urgent need for higher confessional theological education in Africa. We need more missionaries with significant theological caliber. The time of theological amateurs is over in global missions if we are going to prevail. Unless this can be achieved, the future field of theology as a whole will be seriously handicapped, since the foundation of all true theology, the sacred scriptures, will still be found in the Babylonian captivity of liberal, critical German, Scandinavian, English, and American theologies with their limited and yet strict philosophical presuppositions and categories." This is the new bishop. This is the bishop that has asked us to send professors to teach in Kenya. Kurt Marquardt, Professor Marquardt, was there. I'll be going in January and February. We also have Kenyan students on campus, and we hope to have another one coming. "In Sweden, there are no longer any Lutheran bishops who will ordain men, opposed to the novelty of women's ordination. Before a candidate will be ordained, he is required to receive Holy Communion from a woman priest. As a result, confessional pastors have organized a non-geographical mission diocese and requested Bishop Walter Obari to come up from Kenya to ordain their pastors." The irony of this is because the church was founded by Scandinavian missionaries. Now, what goes around, you know, now he's going to go back and ordain them, that their church needs missionaries, in other words. This has caused quite a stir in the Swedish Lutheran Church. It's all over the public media. Lutheran World Federation headquarters in Geneva is all in a stir. I can't go into it all. It's quite interesting. But the archbishop wrote a letter to Bishop Walter Obari and pleaded with him, "Don't come in here, don't mess around in Sweden." Now, the archbishop can't figure out why the Lutheran World Federation keeps wanting to introduce the homosexual agenda into the churches of Kenya. As he put it, he says, "We got a problem with polygamy, and we're not making polygamy a problem for Sweden." Well, the archbishop wrote this letter, and I'm not going to read the whole thing. I'll just say he used the word in one paragraph, perspective, three times. Everything's a perspective to them. Nothing's sure theology. And he said, you know, there's these, as he would put it, these more conservative pastors that, you know, want to force their perspective on the whole church rather than keep church unity. Well, it's a farce. Here is the answer of Obari, and we have just a few minutes, but you've got to hear this. He wrote back to the Swedish Bishop Hummer, "Lutherans as well as other Christians in growing number in very parts of the world are becoming more and more aware of the situation in present and former Lutheran state churches in Scandinavia and Germany. Classic Christianity, set forth especially in the Lutheran confessions, has come under oppression and even persecution in those historically established Lutheran churches. For years, indeed for decades, men called by God and qualified by theological studies have been denied ordination. Behind these young men, there are Christians of rank and file, their congregations who suffer together with them. We are witnessing the rise of a secular, intolerant, bureaucratic fundamentalism inimical to the Word of God. Ordination of women to the apostolic office of the ministry is a novelty, known historically solely from various Gnostic heretic churches. This Gnostic novelty is now obviously claiming not only autocracy in the church, but also tyranny, since it cannot tolerate even minimal coexistence with classical Christianity, especially set forth in the Lutheran confessions. It is very hard and very painful to me to imagine how any conscientious church leadership could stand against the Word of God and the Lutheran confessions. It is heartening to find faithful bishops and pastors and lay people all over the world who reject the theology and practice of the liberal churches in Europe and in North America. It is impossible for our seminary to fulfill all the requests that we have around the world for students that want to study here and to send our professors everywhere they're asked to go. But we're doing everything we can. Now, I've got about 7 minutes, and I just made this PowerPoint presentation, which is the first time I've ever done this. And I didn't have a chance to time it, so I'm going to have to do some very quick editing here. The next section was on India, and you'll just shoot through these and show the work that we've done, started to do. That's a seminary, and the first visit, we've had three professors study there. They also have an orphanage and a Lutheran school. They must have 50 to 100 churches, I can't remember. I'm kind of hoping one day we can have our deaconesses do a missionary internship there at the orphanage and at the school. On to Madagascar. That's just a very interesting story I can't go into, but I will say that their church is as large as Missouri Synod, maybe larger, 2.6 million people there. Their vice president, Modesto Rokoto, and their dean of the graduate seminary were invited here at the last symposia. They sat and they spent a lot of time sitting in classes, meeting with President Wenthe and the administration, and as a result, we will be sending two professors to teach in Madagascar in the next few months, into next year. And we have one student here now, and we expect another one to do graduate work here. Move on to West Africa, Nigeria. In the 1950s, boy, you're good. In the 1950s and 60s, the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod had more missionaries in Nigeria than any other country in the world. We recently have one Nigerian student on campus, Michael Odoga, and he will complete his MA degree this month and then go back to teach at the Lutheran Seminary in Obet Edom. I have to put in a personal note here because in the early 1960s, my father was a missionary in Nigeria, and he served as the president of this seminary. I was in high school at the time, but it left quite an impression. I just loved Nigeria. I didn't want to leave. I had the opportunity to return to Nigeria a couple years ago. I hate to think of it, after 40 years or so of being gone. It was remarkable to look at the house. Oh, that's the seminary. The seminary is a lot bigger. That's just one of the buildings. But that's the house that I lived in, and now a Nigerian professor lives there. But it was quite interesting to go back into the jungle, and place that I loved. Rwanda. Shoot through some of these scenes of Rwanda. I just can't go into that now, but we've taught some pastors there. The genocide that killed, I don't know, somewhere between half a million and a million really devastated the place. But it's a beautiful country with a nice climate. Benin, I was there, and I wish I could tell you about the voodoo and the lecture we gave when the big voodoo guys came in. We finished our lecture and got out of there. There was some big chief guy with a bunch of bodyguards. They didn't like what we were doing. Anyway, let's go on to Mongolia. I think then we'll... 2 years ago, I received an intriguing email from a Mongolian missionary, a Finnish missionary. The Finnish and the Norwegian missionaries have been working in Mongolia for 6 or 7 years. Now they have a few mission stations in the countryside. They are looking for a good seminary at which to train Mongolian men for the ministry. They also have a small congregation in the capital city of Ulaanbaatar. Buddhism dominates both the countryside and the capital. I have to say that it was because I met a Finnish missionary in Lake Victoria in Africa, and he had a relative that was married to a missionary, and this missionary. And then out of the blue, 2 months later or so, I got an email from his relative's husband, missionary, saying, we can't find a good seminary to send our future prospective candidates to. We can't send them to Finland or Sweden. How about Fort Wayne? Well, Alexei Streltsov, who is the rector you saw at the Novosibirsk Seminary, a couple years ago we made a trip to Mongolia. We met with the missionaries and determined that the best place for their men to study was in Novosibirsk. I won't go into all the reasons. Maybe someday there'll be a Mongolian here, but at this level, at this point, that would be better. The church is still small. Most of the Norwegian work has been in areas of social work, not evangelism, but things are changing. A couple years ago, President Wenthe goes to a NELA conference, a theological conference in Finland. You know, he likes to schmooze and talk to the young seminarians. And he gets talking to this nice-looking young Swedish fellow married to a Norwegian wife. And so the Norwegians send him over. And he's very theological, very confessional, very interested in true evangelism, bringing Christ to lost. And and building a solid church. He's even written us, and we've sent him books or stuff. We sent him Barry's whatabouts. Remember those things? Because he said, this is what we need, a bunch of little stuff answering all these questions. I just sent the whole thing, and you can do one at a time. Anyway, because he met Wenthy, he emailed him, because of it, this young man will be visiting Novosibirsk when he gets a chance, and hopefully send Mongolians there. I cannot tell you how often people have asked me when they hear about Concordia Theological Seminary and all the stuff we've been doing around the world, and I've just touched part of it today. They often express amazement at the accomplishments. I myself am just kind of bewildered. I was just, I was content in my parish in St. Louis and content in graduate school. Now I just can't believe all this stuff. But it could not have been done, of course, without the Lord who provided and blessed it. It could not be done without generous support of members of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod who love our Lord and who love good theology and who love missions. But mostly, did you see that picture of that faculty? That's where I want to end, because anytime somebody asks me, well, how do you do this? And I go, well, it's, how do you win a race when you got a barn full of thoroughbreds? I look at these, and, we have to send professors over, and they just do an incredible job. I mean, you have to be pretty bad not to be able to accomplish something with these men. I tell you, I stand in really awe and respect of them. I believe... that's a good place to end.